Hello and welcome back to Podcast from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. And welcome to 2025. It has a sort of consequential ring to it, I think. I hope you're all rested and safely home. We're already deep into the new year, new cycle, and while it's dominated by the antics of Donald Trump and Elon Musk ahead of Trump's inauguration in a few days' time, our own basket is filling up quite quickly too. January and February are busy months in South Africa politically, particularly as the ANC and its government have a series of meetings and discussions that are supposed to culminate in the President's State of the Nation debate in early February and the annual budget a little later in the month. And then there's always the health or otherwise of the Government of National Unity, the GNU, to worry about. That's something new, but it's real. The DA seems to have allowed the ANC to cross one red line with the Basic Education Laws Amendment Bill Bella coming into force, with the rider that the DA Minister of Basic Education will first be allowed to write the regulation that will describe how the law is to be interpreted and enacted. If that's to be taken as the DA is trying to take it, if the DA win, I'm sure they won't mind when national health insurance comes into effect, perhaps waiting and sitting in a committee that will write the regulations for that. I fear good DA leader John Steenhuisen is about to be royally, shall we say, outflanked. But to talk about the year ahead, I've got one of my favorite people with me, Songe Zozibi, now head of the Rise Mzansi Party, chair of the Standing Committee on Public Accounts in Parliament, former editor of Business Day, all-round good guy. He's also now the author of his own Substack, and Songe is going to tell us what a Substack is in a minute. It's a sort of publicly available column that people who've got something to say right online and to which you can subscribe. All the best people are doing it. And so, Songezo, welcome and happy new year. Start with the Substack briefly. How are you doing it? Do you have enough? Don't you have enough exposure already? What's it called and how do people follow it?
So Substack, I mean, I only just joined, Peter, myself. And happy new year to you, by the way, everyone who's listening to this. So I only just joined literally a week and a half ago, because Wandile Sihlobo, the agricultural economist,
yes,
has been kind of cajoling and begging me to join. But if I can simplify, if you don't like the toxicity and stupidity that you see on Twitter, and to a less degree on Facebook, Substack is a place to go. You get a combination of people, serious people and not so serious people, but everybody applies themselves properly in terms of what they want to write. You get columnists from some of the best publications in the world, and most of the content is free. And you can get it as an app, whether you're on Android or iPod. Yeah.
But so I had a look at, when I try to subscribe, you say it's free. When I try to subscribe, it wanted money from me.
You must have chosen somebody who's money.
I've got no money. I'm poor. I've just had Christmas.
My content is free. And by the way, Peter, notwithstanding, I've received about $24 in voluntary donations from people. I don't know how to get them because I hadn't chosen to monetize, but I bought $8 and somebody gave like $16 to me.
You're a public, and yeah, so you, a lot of people I do sort of look at every now and again ask me to buy them a cup of coffee, which I think is also a feature of Substack life. I don't buy the coffee because I don't know how to, and you never know where your money's going. But anyway, thank you for that. Listen now, we're going to the new year. Not much change from the way we came out of the old one. Poverty and unemployment are still our friends. Hundreds of what we like to call illegal miners are starving and dying down a mine near Joburg, which, you know, as a city is itself collapsing. And yet, insistent voices are beginning to tell us that things are on the very cusp, on the very edge of change, particularly in rail and at Transnet. There's a flood of stories now, I'm sure you've been reading them, promising us huge new investment. What's the year looking like from your perspective?
Peter, the year is quite foggy for me. I mean, there is lots of different things smelling in the air and things that are floating about. But it's kind of difficult at this point to say with definitively, you know, whether things are looking up or they're going to remain stagnant or go down. Let's take, you made an example about Transnet, for instance. Now, the chair of Transnet is somebody I know. I speak to some of the chairs of state-owned enterprises in my new job, from time to time, about their businesses and how things are going. The thing is, we can talk up Transnet or Prasa in any of these places as much as we like. The reality is that they need recapitalization, and there's still no money on the table. Barbara Creasy told my committee that they need about 240 billion between them. That's Transnet and Prasa. Now, I can tell you, Peter, we're not going to get that kind of money in the next month or two, right? Yeah. And what's important, and the reason I'm saying it can be a bit foggy, is that I want to see that budget in February. I want to see that State of the Nation address saying, not something generic like, we're going to get private investment. I want to hear we getting, you know, $3 billion in from so-and-so to go into Transnet. That's what I want to hear.
Yeah.
And it's not there yet. So I'm withholding my optimism. I'm definitely withholding it.
But that's surely the sensible thing to do, right? So Business Day reporting the other day that, according to Standard Bank, water and rail are going to get a 700 billion rand sort of, windfall over the next 3 years, and that this is going to revive all sorts of things. And it's sure, and the minister has put out the sort of rail plan, a rail statement for the next year or so. It's surely still all just talk. And we have to be not patient, we have to be skeptical, surely.
No, I think the adult thing to do is to be skeptical. Show me the money. Talk is cheap. Hey, honestly, show me the money.
Yeah.
And that's the responsibility of the president and other ministers. And the time to show the money is February. It's not too far away.
Yeah. Well, what do you think the chances are? I mean, Scopa gives you some insight into what the public finances look like.
Look, we're not going to get that money from public finances. And I won't go into, you know, some of the offline conversations I have, but I met the finance minister recently, late last year. And one of the things I asked him to come and present to the committee about is the state of government finances, and he agreed. Because I think it's important that South Africans know how much money the government has and how much money the government needs from elsewhere, and that there is no time to play around with silly ideological games. Either that train from Naledi to Park Station takes 35 minutes as it should, or it continues to take an hour, 40 minutes.
Yeah.
As it does now. I know the latter is unsustainable. And if we really care about the well-being and success of the people that live in Soweto that need to get to the CBD, we will go and find the money elsewhere. And there is money available in South Africa, Peter. And I think there's money available overseas too.
Yeah. But are we ready to take it? Are the conditions right in South Africa for that money? I mean, we put so many barriers in the way. A clean, what we would normally call a foreign investment, you know, be a British money into Italy or British, you know, French money into Australia, wherever. But South Africa is more complicated. I mean, BE complicates it. There are all sorts of, it is just more complicated, Chair. And also not necessarily that attractive.
No, Peter, it's the complication that exists in the heads of the ANC. That's where the complication is, Peter. You know, I often make this example because I sometimes want to reinvent the wheel when they shouldn't. Peter, the government doesn't own a single truck that travels on South Africa's roads, not one, okay? Except maybe army trucks and, you know, correctional services ferrying prisoners from one place to the next. Even Public Works doesn't own trucks anymore. Nobody frets about the fact that the government owns the roads but none of the trucks. But Jesus, dare not mention rail where you want to do exactly the same damn thing. Somebody says, oh no, you can't do it. Why not? You already do it in case of the roads. You already do it in case of shipping. None of the ships that come in and out of the country belong to this government. So what I'm saying, Peter, the ANC has got to get over its ideological dogmas. Privatization doesn't have to mean all the time somebody owning a slice of a state-owned entity.
Yeah.
It might just mean concessioning a part of our infrastructure for the public good and setting the rules in such a way that they are transparent and the value to the public and to the economy can be measured by people evaluating the information independently, and as well as committees like mine in Parliament.
I'm trying to think of a recent. So steel is a good example, right? ArcelorMittal has decided to mothball its long products division, the entire division, and it's astonishing how much misinformation there is about long products and the end of this sort of thing. You know, the first voices you hear are people saying nationalize it, we should never have unnationalized it, or whatever it might be. The second are, you know, this is the end of long products in South Africa. Everybody's going to have to import them. Whereas, in fact, part of the reason AMSA's had to stop its long products is that they're already being produced at a subsidized price in South Africa by many mills, because the government is subsidizing the price of scrap, or not subsidizing, but forcing scrap to be sold to the mini mills at a 30% discount, which is huge. Nobody can compete with that. And, you know, I just can't help thinking that the government, as far as investment is concerned, has got itself completely sort of twisted. It mixes up transformation and it mixes up investment, and it can't tell the difference between what success looks like and what failure looks like. You know, it's, you and I would recognize investment as a certain amount of money being invested in a project, and, you know, with the people who put the money into it expecting a return. But in the ANC's mind, it's something else entirely.
Look, I think, Peter, we suffer from a couple of things. I mean, the first is a nostalgia for the apartheid days, by the way. By the ANC themselves, which is, you know, when you could have the maize board and the whatever board and the beef board and so on, setting prices, some version of capitalist collectivism of sorts, right? Where you need all of this stuff that you need to produce, and we do it ourselves for our people and this kind of thing. I mean, really. Yeah. The world over, that was a thing in the 1960s and 1970s. And then it just began to wane as a thing. They've never gotten over it. And you know, even black nationalists, and I am one, Peter, to some degree. You sit in these conversations where people talk about what the Afrikaners used to do and that kind of thing. You're like, you say that was bloody 1948, man. This is not 1948, it's 2024. So there is that of wanting to go back to the old days. And in a way, it's what Trump is selling in the US. The old days when we could make things ourselves, you know. Okay, so that's one. The second thing, Peter, is that they don't understand a political economy, actually.
Yeah.
They never have. I mean, they have to a limited degree, but generally they don't. And what do I mean by that? They don't understand that, you know, the world and economies evolve. And what was working for you 30 years ago or in the last 30 years is not what's going to take you forward in the next 30. And you use your competitive advantage or natural endowment to the extent that you have one. And we've got a few. You use them differently over time, right?
Yeah, sure. So,
and I think that is the thing we miss. You got to think in terms of objectives, I think, Peter. What do you want? What do we want is to lower input costs so that we can be competitive and produce the things that we want. The whole theory of producing something yourself is an assumption that it's cheaper. When that assumption is no longer true, it's not working for you, right?
Yeah.
You got to think about ways in which you get this input and how you pivot and use this advantage difference. Now, when you are married to the period between 48 and 82, you can't think like that at all. And you're going to block mergers, you're going to block acquisitions, you're going to block innovation, you're going to block integration with the world. And, you know, and I think that's where we are, Peter.
Yeah. No, I'm sure you're right. Yeah. So given all of that, let's just talk about the government of national unity for a while, because the last time we spoke, I asked you what the prognosis was and how long you remember this on for. how long you gave it so that we could call it, you know, working or not working. You said 7 months. And 7 months is, you're about a month away from there now. How's it going?
No, Peter, I think it's going well. And the 7 months was, if this cabinet can produce a budget that gets tabled and they vote for it, and that was the 7 months, then there are points of agreement and they see a future together for at least 3 years. Because those are the budget cycles that we have, and we will have a budget. And when I met the finance minister, he didn't complain about having a headache in terms of putting it together. And we did speak a little bit about how things are going and so on, right? So I am optimistic, Peter, that at that level, the 7 months will be navigated successfully. That's the first thing. So I was going to say the second thing, Peter, is having been in a couple of meetings, including the Bella meetings, by the way, having been in a couple of meetings, I really have to say that notwithstanding the political grandstanding and all of this, there is one thing that unites all the parties, and that's a desire to make the GNU work, honestly. The ANC can't afford for the GNU to fail because its internal problems multiply. Yeah. The DA, I don't get a sense that it's working against the GNU. There are genuine differences, yes, but I also get a sense that they want to make it work. And I've been in meetings with both Helen and with John, you know, at different levels. And similarly with the other political parties. I think that's a hell of a good thing, right? Yeah. And I think, Peter, if you take those two things together and the fact that we managed to navigate the Bella thing successfully, and I think John was correct, it is a win-win. Then the prognosis for the next 3 years is good.
With or without the NHI coming up for the same sort of treatment?
The NHI can be negotiated. If there's one thing, Peter, that I learned from the Bella thing is that if everybody approaches this in good faith and wants actual outcomes rather than cheap, you know, just political wins outside, you can get to a solution that works. You don't have to know what that solution is going into the discussion.
Yeah.
But you got to be determined to find one at the end.
It becomes apparent during a conversation.
Yeah. It was apparent during the conversation. So what I'm saying, Peter, is that we have had a dry run in terms of Bella, which for me was never a big deal, to be honest with you, apart from the political grandstanding. I always felt that where we ended up is where everybody should have just gone to, because, you know, the minister is a DA minister. They determine how and when the law is going to be implemented, and let's leave them to do their work. But that said, Peter, you know, there will be bumps in the road, but I remain optimistic.
Yeah. And you quickly, one more thing on the GNU. I mean, does it, when we talk about it surviving, and obviously you're going to get through one budget now, 2029 is still a very long way away, and it's obviously got to, you know, there will be lots of other bumps in the road, and one of them, I'm sure, and we can, you know, talk about, oh, maybe I'll talk about it or write about it later on, is a not a possible but a probable leadership change in the DA in the middle of this cycle, because the DA is due to hold an elective conference next year, and indeed may do so this year. And I don't think John Steenhuisen is going to survive that. What would be the implications of him not being around, or maybe in his job as minister? That might be part of the deal that he is offered, but somebody else leading the party, possibly not even in the cabinet.
Yeah, look, Peter, I think both the ANC and the DA face similar risks. I don't think John is on his, in and of himself, is a factor in how, in whether the GNU survives or not with the DA in it, right? But I think the internal dynamics in the DA matter more. And some of the personalities who are not in cabinet, like Helen Zille and others. Similarly, in the ANC, you know, they're going to have a leadership change in this cycle. And it's anybody's guess who that process is going to spit out at the end of it and what their attitude is to the GNU. So if I were to ask people to put a marker down, it's not 2029, It's December 2027 when the ANC has its
has to be France. Big one. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Cyril has to, or President Ramaphosa has to either be able to control his own succession or face the prospect of not being there by the end of 2028.
Yeah, no, absolutely, Peter. I totally agree. And I am not certain that he's the type to want to control his succession, unfortunately. Okay. So yeah, it is going to be a bit of a dog's breakfast.
Yeah. And just talk to me a little bit about Razem Zansi. You know, you've got two MPs and you got a really tiny slice of the vote in last May 29th. And I know I've asked you this before, but let's just go over it one more time quickly, even for last time ever. What do you think happened? And because I know you were expecting a bit more. What did it teach you about our politics?
Well, it taught me two things, Peter. The first is that some of the old political adages or, you know, frames are true. And that is, you always begin with the middle class. Always. The ANC began that way. Even some of the more famous revolutionaries from elsewhere were professionals and the middle class. And we made a critical mistake, and that was to go for the mass vote in and of itself, without building a strong professional and middle-class base so that it can carry your mass vote over time. So that was a strategic error that we made. The second was that we went for AMC areas. And while MK didn't exist, we're doing great. The moment MK came into existence, we're doing very badly in those areas. And the combination of these two things was just unhelpful.
So the other thing that I want to ask you about Razem Zansi is why you joined Panyaza Lesufi's government in Gauteng. Is he really the kind of political leader you are comfortable being associated with? I mean, you sort of legitimize him in a way by being there. You make him look better. You make his government look better than it is.
No, Peter, that question arises only in so far as the DA is not part of that government. We have been consistent. I mean, when we took a decision to join the GNU, we knew that it would have national and provincial implications. And between the DA and ourselves, we're exactly in the same boat. And the only reason that now matters is that the DA and the ANC didn't find each other in Gauteng. And the ANC national leadership didn't force an agreement. Otherwise, there's nothing inconsistent for us. For me, it's not about Panyaza. Listen, even at national level, we forget, but we've got a president who stuffed his couch with money. Okay. But we haven't worked.
Well, he didn't personally. He was aware when all that happened.
Well, Peter, the reality is, I feel like trying to kind of nitpick the AMC like into good guys and bad guys is such a futile exercise. You've got to accept the beast that you're working with and have very clear objectives in terms of what you're wanting to do. And for us, it's always been about showing what we do when we govern, either in parliament or in the executive. And the first corruption scandal in Gauteng in this term has been exposed by our MEC in the Department of Agriculture, which wouldn't have happened under an ANC MEC, I can tell you. Okay. You know what I mean? So, in order to sustain yourself as a political party, you've got to show that you are different. Otherwise, you go to the next election and people think, "When? Why are you different?"
Yeah. So, Songezo, so moving along, because this is all nice, and so, you know, the beginning of the year will evolve the way it does, you know, the ANC will have a number of indabas and bosparats and we'll end up with the Sona, et cetera, et cetera. But I read your Substack last week, and you were very concerned, and I think we probably all are. And in fact, you put very well what a lot of people are thinking. You know, as Trump and Elon Musk tear into the sort of liberal order, which is what's happening to us. You know, and where do we begin to look for truth, or at least some sort of, where are we safe? You write in the thing in their Substack. What happens when it's no longer possible for most people to know the truth, even in the present day, let alone the past? What happens when the past is retold to millions of people who have neither the appetite nor the capacity to find out in a way that completely distorts it? This is one of the features of the modern internet age, the seemingly concerted efforts to influence people's understanding of their current realities, to destroy their ability to access, consume, and analyze accurate information. It's destroying human beings' willingness and ability to listen intently and to make decisions in good faith. And you're clearly talking there about what we've been seeing in America, really, with, you know, post, before and after, particularly after the Donald Trump's election victory in early November, and the way Elon Musk particularly has been able to use the you know, Twitter, which he bought 2-3 years ago now, to completely overturn the way political debate happens in the world. It's extraordinary what's happening, isn't it? And it's terrifying too.
Bila, it's extraordinary. And to somebody who's listening to this, let me put it this way. You know, technology changes our day-to-day, almost instinctive behavior in many ways. You know, before smartphones, Bila, had cameras. Before phones, cell phones had cameras. You never used to see people, as soon as they see like greenery and flowers and so on, stop to take a picture. Yeah. You know what I mean? Or take a picture of their food and want to share it with others and that kind of thing. But all of these instincts have now been introduced in, you know, into our... No, but they accept these as normal. And we seem to have believed that politics would be different. Of course, it won't be different.
Yeah.
Here's my concern, Peter, you know, to the extent that you've read, is that the fundamental assumption of a democracy is that we are able to access accurate information, but we differ on what it means for the decisions, political decisions that we've got to make. And that gets sorted out by discourse, which is between people with divergent views. That is the theory.
Yeah.
I think it's important that we accept that that theory is gone. And when that theory no longer applies in practice, then democracy is under threat. What Trump and Elon, as proxies of this universe that we talk about, have accepted and understood is what I've just explained to you. And that in that context, the truth is whatever you make people believe. The truth is whatever you make people believe. And on that basis, you go on to step two, which is to make them take further political actions, which the rest of us might think, oh, but, you know, how can this work? But the wall that protects them from being convinced is how these algorithms work, where I only get to see what you tweet, Peter, because you and I agree on most things. And the people that don't agree with me, even then their views are moderate, it feels so offensive and shocking that I want to scream at them rather than listen to them. And that's where we are. And I think, Peter, this is not going to stop. It's just going to keep getting worse, for lack of a better word. And it's going to lead to an entirely new reality where a guy like Trump becomes par for the course rather than an exception.
So what's the result of it going to be? I mean, let's talk about generally and about South Africa. I mean, so what we have now in our phones, this is, you know, social media was designed initially to pull people together. What it's ended up doing is dividing us in a way. And what you know, what we have in our hands, in our pockets, on our tables next to the bed as a weapon. Can it be controlled? I mean, you know, the Australians are going to prevent people under, I don't know, 14 or 10 or whatever it might be, from having a cell phone. Okay, that's a bit of, what I'm not trying to say is whether you stop people, but up to now, it's been largely unregulated. You know, and Does regulation of social media now become a prospect, or is it just ridiculous to think about anything like that? Because there's so many ways around it, and you drive these things underground at your peril.
No, Peter, you know, I don't think social media should be banned, by the way. So the problem is fundamentally in the United States from a legal perspective, and that is there is some law from 1992, I forget what it is, and Castore has written about it, but it prevents regulation of the internet.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, the internet has to be regulated, Peter, and these are some of the things that could be done, right? For instance, social media creates a platform for people to exist in the same digital universe. What can be prevented by law is a segmentation of those people that choose to live there by the technology companies. So in other words, if you get onto, I don't know, Church Square in Pretoria, you deal with whoever is there. There is nobody saying, if you like people who speak Isipedi or whatever, and I'm really being simplistic now, there's your corner there, create your own bubble there, and it is okay. No, actually, I think they must not be allowed to do that, because it is in their choice to do that, that the conflicts can be stoked. So in other words, it's okay as long as it still resembles the public square, because the discourse in a democracy is important. What we've heard so far is that the conflict becomes the thing that drives the monetization of the platform. And that specific thing can be outlawed, Peter, without banning the platform, to say, you know, but you can't make money out of certain anti-democratic sort of a things in your technology. You've got to take them down. And this is not different, Peter. In Europe, as you know, they break down large companies all the time. They will say company A is too big, it needs to split, right? The state doesn't own it. It's still owned by private owners, but to becoming a monopoly now, you got to do something different. So we need to evolve how we think about technology and freedom of speech and protecting democracy.
I mean, one of the ways, what should be illegal is in a democracy is, I mean, you can't make lying illegal, but you can make false accusation illegal, or you can make it actionable anyway.
You and I need to have a conversation with Franny Repkin, our former colleague, right? Because I had this exact conversation with her. And I said, you know, you are free to be mistaken. But when we can prove that you are deliberately creating a platform of lies in order to influence public opinion and influence democratic outcomes, that can be unlawful, surely.
Well, we just undone the law of crimen injuria. You know, I was once, as editor of the Financial Mail, I was criminally charged with libel in about 1997. No, it was terrifying because somebody had written something. I was on holiday, but because I was the editor, I was accountable, and I was sat in the dock at the Joburg Magistrates Court for 3 days while somebody, and a very clever lawyer, got me off on a technicality. Thank heavens, but but now the law doesn't exist any longer, crimen injuria, and maybe it should. Maybe it should come back again, because that's what you see a lot of now on Twitter, on X particularly. I mean, I don't really follow the others all that much, but the real poison is on Musk's platform, and you know you kind of have to be there, because it's still a really good news source. But, you know, some of the lies being told about people are quite breathtaking.
Peter, you must, I'll send you a video later from TikTok. That purports to show Nelson Mandela's grave on Robben Island.
Oh, God.
I don't know if you know about this guy, and a gentleman called Gibson Makanda. Gibson Makanda is the imposter that you and I say was a great guy, you know, post-prison, right? And you know, led South Africa's transition and that sort of thing. Madiba died in prison. Alternately, you know, he actually was never in prison. He went overseas because he was a CIA spy.
Yes.
Peter,
yes.
The number of, if you read the comments, it's depressing.
Yeah.
Because they're like, finally, we get to hear the truth. We always thought. Now, Peter, somebody who tells that sort of thing should be locked up, man. I'm sorry.
But I mean, but this is the point, you know. You can't. How do you look on social media? I never see any of the comments about anything I say or I write. You can block them out. So I see comments from people I follow, and that's it. Nobody else. And I presume I'd be horrified if I did see them. I mean, I once did about 2-3 years ago, and I was horrified. It was completely terrifying.
We spoke. You called me. Peter.
Oh man. But you know, you're going to get more of it. And now Facebook is going to be doing it as well, because Mark Zuckerberg has now also going to remove all controls on content. And rather, you know, his argument is that you know, if we make mistakes, the community will correct them in their own way, which is, so he's also going to do these kind of community notes, which of course is not the point. By the time the community has responded to some tweet, people have forgotten about it. The damage to you as a person has been done. And what did Franny Rapkin, who's also very, very normally very good on these things, what was her position on all of this stuff? What do we do about libel online?
She didn't want people ending up in the position that you ended up in the 90s, right? Which is, you could, you know, what kind of abuses can be visited on people as a result of making a law like that?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. We had a long phone conversation because I was feeling quite exercised by it. And I mean, her thoughts hadn't completely formed. It would be interesting to hear what she's got to say about it now with the benefit of more evidence and time.
Yeah.
But you know, Peter, there even the comments that you talk about that you say used to freak you out, some of those comments, I would say close to 40% of them, are part of the same deliberate strategy, right? To say, to destroy the truth. So especially on sort of in the US, Peter, where it becomes a reinforcement of the initial lie, so that it gives you the impression that the majority of people believe this nonsense when it is not true. It's incredibly frustrating. And I think the responses can be both statutory, Peter, but also in terms of other controls as well, in terms of what we teach in school. I mean, I'm surprised. Part of our life orientation in schools is not teaching kids more pointedly about the meaning of social media, rather than saying, you know, don't talk to strangers and allow them to message.
That's all.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I talk to my kids about the
What does it do to our democracy? You know, it's so precious, particularly in this country. You say in your Substack, further down, I don't know how possible democratic discourse survives when we do not have the muscle to debate with civility, without resorting to base insults, because we're simply no longer used to any opinion different to ours. In my view, you say, this inevitably will lead to the rise of fascist tendencies and eventually fascism. Well, I mean, you know, we're not the most solid democracy in the world. I mean, we might have a great constitution, but we're still young and brittle and fragile. So, I mean, how dangerous is this for us?
In fact, Peter, I would say it's probably more dangerous for us than it is for the Europeans, for instance, specifically because we don't have a culture of democracy, right? And what we understand to be fascist tendencies, people don't see them as fascist at all, because we not European, we black, we're not white, and that kind of thing. But I'll give you a small example from the campaign, Peter, from the election campaign. So we use a church venue. We're not in the church, but the service had finished, and after it was our political event. And some of the church people stayed behind and they listened. And this old lady said, you know, I really like you guys. I really, really like you. But can you just, if you to just remove the right to gay marriage in the constitution, I would definitely vote for you. Hmm. Right? And now we had this conversation with a lady about how to navigate a way out of this kind of thing. And eventually she agreed. But can you imagine how attractive it would be, Peter, if somebody who in terms of, let's say, has got rational ideas, is articulate and so on, also says, you know, gay marriage is, you know, it shouldn't be allowed. And also we must get rid of foreigners. Right?
Yeah.
That becomes such a dangerous cocktail because you can subsidize those hateful views with absolutely great knockout ideas on the economy and crime and everything else. And you can have a fascist country. So South Africa is very vulnerable, Peter, because people are willing to do these trade-offs all the time, which is, if I'm going to get my services, we can have the death penalty and cops can shoot criminals on the street and I won't mind.
Yeah. Does it, is there anything that the, you know, politicians, people like yourself, should be doing in this coming parliament? I mean, does it at least get discussed in parliament? Does a threat of abuse get discussed somehow in parliament? Then whose job, who's, you know, which minister, which portfolio committee does it belong to? You know, it can't just be Posts and Telegraphs. It'll end up being Gayton McKenzie. I mean, putting Gayton in, sorry, I mean, you know, I've got nothing against him personally, but putting Gayton in charge of our collective morality, I don't think is also going to be that productive.
No, I mean, one of the people I'm going to have a conversation with is Solima Lazi, the Minister of Communication and Digital Technologies,
yeah,
as well as the chair of the Portfolio Committee, Kusela, who might discuss these matters at length, by the way, when she used to work for the president. So yeah, it's not an old conversation. And I think that's where it ordinarily stays. I think it needs to work in tandem with the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development.
Yeah.
Got a chance services. But here's what I'm intending to do personally, Peter. Part of the reason I have a Substack, and I'm going to be doing a lot of other things in the misinformation space, what we need to do is we need to make the truth more interesting. We need to make the truth more conflictual, if that makes sense. In other words, we need to get into the boxing ring and needle certain peddlers of misinformation and get into a fight with them and demonstrate to the public that they are lying. In other words, we use the same drug that feeds misinformation, which is the bloodlust.
Yeah.
And what does bloodlust on behalf of the truth look like, right? And I'd like to do that. You remember when I was on 702 and Brian Molefe called in?
Yes, I do.
That went hell of well because
yeah,
it was a conflict situation and people love a fist fight. And I think the people who stand for the truth, Peter, must be prepared to get into more fist fights rather than
yeah,
stepping away. That's what I think.
Yeah. I like that. I like the question. What does bloodlust on behalf of the truth look like? You don't have an answer yet, but I'm going to get you back on this podcast in the second half of the year, and I'm going to remember this, and I want to ask you what the answer is. We've got to stop now, Songezo. But thank you, Songezo Zibi, for talking to me, and many good wishes for the new year. We'll all be watching how you move in your many roles this year, and I hope you'll come back later in 2025. And thank you for listening. I'll be back next week with another edition of Podcast from the Edge. So goodbye and take care.